Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Once again, folks, my name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. As always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. And I also want to welcome our resident guest host, Dave Cooper. So hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hello.
Hello, Lynn.
Huh? And everybody.
Fine, thanks.
Yep.
Great. And today we're discussing the time travel episode titled Back There. Turn it over to Robert now for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
In this rather posh club, you'll see a group of men argue a somewhat metaphysical subject like time travel. One of them maintains it's possible to go back in time, make a few changes in history, and as a result, do quite a job on the present. In this case, the assassination of one Abraham Lincoln. A story called Back There. I'd like you all to come with us. I think you'll find it a most exciting journey.
Thank you very much, Robert. And before I begin, I just want to welcome Kelly to our group. Hello, and it's great
Hi.
To have you here. Hi, good to have you here today.
Nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. And as I mentioned, Back There is a time travel episode starting out with a man named Peter Corrigan sitting at a table in a private club discussing the subject of time travel and whether it would be possible to alter history if one could actually travel back in time. Now, one member believes it's possible, but Peter disagrees by saying that it's impossible to change present-day history. So he gets up to leave, and he accidentally bumps into an attendant named William, who spills coffee on him. And of course, that's no problem. He wipes it off. And it's no big deal. And he walks out of the club to find himself magically transported back to April 14th, 1865, the night of Lincoln's assassination, Abraham Lincoln's assassination. So, Corrigan, he tries to warn people by running to the theater and screaming, "Let me in! The president's going to be shot tonight! The president's going to be shot tonight!" But he ends up being arrested for drunken and disorderly conduct. So John Wilkes Booth goes to the police station, posing as a doctor named Wellington, and he asks to take custody of Corrigan in order to help his troubled mind, and ends up drugging him back to his hotel to keep him from spouting off any further about the shooting. Now, you just go into the police station, and you say you want to take somebody in your custody, and they let you go into their custody. I guess so. But anyway, when Peter finally wakes up, he realizes he's too late to stop anything. He finds out that Wellington was really Booth, and when he returns to the present time of 1961, he finds that other than a handkerchief with Booth's initials on it, the only change that occurred was with William, the attendant who bumped into him. His great grandfather was the only policeman who put any faith in Corrigan's rantings, and because of the publicity he got from knowing that the president would, or at least he surmised that he would be killed that night, he rose to the ranks, he made some land investments, and he became a millionaire. Therefore, William inherited some of that money. So William would never admit to being an attendant at the club. At one time he was an attendant at the club. But Peter knew it, and Peter will always have that handkerchief. So I am totally fine with this episode. It's not a classic. It's not even excellent, in my opinion. But it's a good episode, and it's fairly well done. I mean, you just can't cover every detail in 23 minutes. So you have to have that suspension of disbelief and literary license when it comes to Corrigan simply stepping outside and being transported back to 1865. And even his clothes were changed. I love that. His clothes were changed, everything. So in this episode, Corrigan tries his best to prevent a terrible historical tragedy, but he's prevented from doing so by the very person, the antagonist, who is responsible for the tragedy. One person's life does manage to be affected by Peter's attempts, but the event itself happens as it was fated to happen. Nobody believes his rantings, and only Booth himself found some cause for concern and took control of the situation by stopping any further interference by Peter. Now, one of my all-time favorite movies is The Final Countdown, starring James Farantino. And it's about an American nuclear aircraft carrier. And its crew was sent back in time by a supernatural storm just before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And like Peter Corrigan and back there, the crew on the aircraft carrier tries to alter this historic event with no success. There was just no stopping a Pearl Harbor attack. So
good
a
movie,
question,
definitely.
Exactly. Wonderful movie. Wonderful movie. And the question that's often asked by people who have seen time travel stories such as The Final Countdown and episodes like Back There is, what's the point? Or what's the message of the story? And the answer that inevitably always comes back is that even if one tries to alter history, the paradox of time travel prevents this from happening. And also, Bobby and I had a long discussion about this episode last night, and he asked me if I thought I'd recognize John Wilkes Booth if I went back to that point in time. You know what? I don't believe that I'd automatically recognize him. The man was a nice-looking man. It's a guy with dark hair and a dark mustache. And come on, do you think he was the only man who looked like that? Come on, it's one thing to say we'd recognize Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, because that tragedy wasn't so long ago. It wasn't 100 years ago. And we saw this man's image everywhere, including on live television. But John Wilkes Booth was, what, he was around close to 150 years ago. All we have are some old photos of him in history books. I wouldn't even attempt to say I'd recognize someone from that long ago. It would be too vague. It's one thing to see a photo and another to see someone face-to-face 100 years in the past. I might be wrongly accusing another man, an innocent man. So I guess it would be interesting if people could go back in time and change history, but who would get the chance to change it, and what would they do? You can't just let anyone do that. I might change it one way, and Robert or Bobby or Dave might change it another way. And so I guess that's just another reason why the past can't be undone. I like the story. I like the acting in this episode. Russell Johnson did a great job as Corrigan, a little over the top at times, but you know, it was quite a contrast from his mild-mannered role in Execution. But he was fine. I also like the slight twist at the end regarding William the Attendant. And by the way, Raymond Bailey, who played the man who believed he could change time, went on to play Jed Clampett's ass-kissing banker in the Beverly Hillbillies with a very nice toupee. And the actor who played Booth, John Lassell, he did a fine job. So my rating is 3 for good on this one. And, Robert, I'm going to send this on to you.
And I'll pass it over like football.
Oh, yes,
playing football.
I'm sorry.
Here.
We were passing
it over to Dave.
Yes, okay, I apologize. Dave, it's all yours.
Oh, thanks. Actually, I felt as though I was going to enjoy this one more than I did. I gave it a fairly middle-of-the-road rating of 3 out of 5, and that surprised me because I do like time travel as a concept, and I do like time travel stories. Perhaps I feel somewhat slightly swindled by the cut price way, let's put it, that he actually moved in time. He just sort of had a slight fainting attack outside the door of the club. We switched the electric light changes to gas light. And suddenly, as we move back from the gas light, he's in different clothes. So I thought that was a little bit weak, the way they actually did that. I mean, usually with Twilight Zone, they have like a double interpretation. So I was thinking he might have like stumbled on his way out and perhaps knocked his head. So is he imagining it because he's knocked his head, or is he actually travelled in time? The other thing that threw me was, I was thinking they were talking in the club quite specifically about the time before the Wall Street crash. So that when the time travel sequence happened, I thought, and it panned back from the thing to reveal the road and the traffic, and you're seeing all these horse-drawn traffic, so I'm thinking, well, that looks a bit old for 1929. I'm sure they were having motor vehicles dominating horses by then. It took me a while to readjust and realise that just because they'd been talking hypothetically about going back to that time, he hadn't had any control over his movement back in time. Indeed, at this point, he doesn't really know he's travelled back in time. He just knows that something's strange. And he actually scoots back to his house and isn't he a lucky man to live so near to his club that it's a couple of streets away, happens to be the oldest residence in the neighbourhood. So, of course, that worked out quite nicely because it meant that his house was still standing in this time period, which was very convenient. And he's surprised, of course, when it's the landlady that opens the door. But he copes with it quite well and she has rooms for let and goes in. And, of course, typical of the day, one would have thought, you know, once you find out he's a professional gentleman, she's a bit more disposed towards him somewhat. And then we have this very elegant couple going to the theatre. And then, of course, he catches on that the president's going to be at the theatre and so on. So in all things, I should have really enjoyed this. But I felt somewhat cheated, as I say, by the way he travelled back in time. And then, of course, it was the whole episode to me was misdirection, which was probably good because you as the viewer, at least me as the viewer, was thinking, oh, this is he's never going to work out. Something's going to happen to foil his plans. A little bit the way that the people with the magical camera, their plans were foiled of making money out of it because, you know, it just that much good luck doesn't just drop into your hands. And indeed, the man himself, the main character, had stated his belief that you couldn't change things in the past, even though he was now urgently trying to change what happened. And this storyline is being dealt with in Star Trek and other stories where, you know, if you had a chance to stop the assassination of somebody, maybe the assassination of Duke Franz Ferdinand or something at the beginning of the First World War, was it in Spain? My history's right. You know, you may have meant that the whole pattern of Europe was completely different. You could say it of the American history as well, that, you know, you meddle about with time at your peril. Anyway, the whole point was we were nicely misdirected so that we get back to the present day and we feel, well, that was a bit of a fool's errand. You know, everything is hunky-dory and back as it was before he left. And we have that little bit of a twist with the chap who Lynn quite rightly said was the attendant at the club. Now he's one of their most prestigious members. And obviously being an older chap than our hero, had actually been a former member there. So the other thing I didn't particularly like, and I know Lynn said she liked the change of costume, but to me that didn't work.
I didn't like the change of costume. I thought it was very strange. He walks out of there and all of a sudden his clothes are changed. I mean, seemed like a split second his clothes are changed.
Very much time tunnel without the time tunnel.
Even the time tunnel.
They changed into their own clothes.
Yeah, they had a double-breasted jacket, and the other one had a black polo neck, a green polo neck, or whatever it was. The lead actor, of course, in this, I'm sure you know him from Gilligan's Island and all that, but I remember him from a marvellous science fiction film called This Island Earth, which, if you've never seen it, I highly recommend.
What's the name of it?
It's called This Island Earth, and I'll put the link into it. It is a really, really good 1950s, early 60s science fiction movie. Oh, put the wrong link in. I will put the correct link in. It's, where's it gone to?
Cool. Yeah, that is a good movie, based about a bunch of scientists that are kidnapped by this alien and goes on from there.
Yeah, it's.
I just think that Russell Johnson, when he walked out of that thing, should have been freaking out more than he was. Come on.
But Russell, like I said before, always play scientists. You notice that?
Yeah.
Doctors.
Yeah. Oh, professors and scientists, exactly.
There's the link to This Island Earth, which was from 1955.
Not always. He sometimes plays other characters. I saw him once play a lawyer on a Perry Mason show.
He's got a long list of credits.
I think it's pretty
And just to finish off, and no doubt Robert will refer to it as well, in Doctor Who, one of the aspects of this story is being dealt with a lot, and that is that the argument that the main character has at the beginning is that some of these things are fixed in time. Well, with Doctor Who, that has been one of the, if you'll excuse the pun, tenets of the show, with David Tennant playing the Tenth Doctor, that there are some things where he can go to a particular time in history and he can change matters for the better, but certain things are fixed points. And I've just got a clip, just a little over a minute, and if you'll bear with me, I know not everybody here is that familiar with Doctor Who, but this is from Fires of Pompeii, which is where the Doctor visits with his companion, and they arrive just before the day that in history the Vesuvius volcano is about to erupt. But they find, in actual fact, this is being engineered by an alien race, because of course this is a science fiction show. So hopefully when I play the clip, you'll understand the reasons for it. Here we go.
His aliens set off the volcano. Doesn't that make you all right? For you to stop it?
Still part of history.
But I'm history to you. You saved me in 2008. You saved us all. Why is that different?
Some things are fixed, some things are in flux. Pompeii is fixed.
How do you know which is which?
Because that's how I see the universe. Every waking second I can see what is, what was, what could be, what must not. It's the burden of the Time Lord, Donna. I'm the only one left.
How many people died?
Stop it!
Doctor! How many people died?
20,000.
Is that what you can see, Doctor? All 20,000? And you think that's all right, do you?
And the point is his companion saying he wants him to have compassion and not let 20,000 people die. But the point is that if he doesn't let those 20,000 people die, this race of people that are actually harnessing the volcano for power will, like, not terraform Earth, but transform Earth into a planet that is suitable for their life form to live. So basically, he has to sacrifice 20,000 people for the whole world. In this particular case, the volcano is a fixed event. The twist in that particular story is the fact that it's not a natural disaster, but it's the disaster that he has to bring about in order to make the volcano go off. And the whole point is that whatever the reason for the volcano going off, the fact that it goes off is a fixed point in time. And he has to go ahead, even with the loss of 20,000 lives. So
he really screws it up with the waters of Mars, though, don't he?
Well, with the waters of Mars, we're coming to what's called the end game of that particular Doctor, where he's beginning to feel he's omnipotent, and he's feeling that the laws of nature are not the laws of nature, but the laws that he allows and the laws that he activates, as it were. And at that point, he's on a dark path,
law.
As it were. Sorry to take you slightly off. So as I say, I gave it a 3 out of 5, which I'm actually surprised with myself, because as a time travel show, I expected I would have given it more. I feel as though a little bit of more money spent on the way that he was transported might just have made it a little bit more convincing in the way it was done. But I did like the fact that it was misdirection.
I agree with you, Dave. I mean, that was the reason I only gave it a 3. I gave it a 3 out of 5 because, I mean, I know that they're, you know, they have a certain amount of time to do this, but, you know, just walking outside and, you know, all of a sudden you walk outside and you're transported. I mean, come on. You know, but other than, you know, that was part of the reason I only gave it a 3 out of 5. And, you know, there were others. I mean, you know, first of all, John Wilkes Booth, he goes in the hospital, or no, I'm sorry, not the hospital, he goes in the police station, and he says, oh, you know, I'm so-and-so, and that guy that you just put in jail, I'd like to take him. Yeah, okay, here you go. Anybody can walk into the police station, take anybody they want home with them.
Yeah, have you got any young girls in the street I can take while I'm at it? Yeah.
I'll take her home with me.
I know who she is. I'll sign her out. I'll put her in my care.
I could not give it any more than a 3. So. But Robert, okay, it's your turn.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, they brought up some really good points, and I just, before I came on, I finally finished my review and sent it on up. It's not much to really say, because Lynn pretty much did the description, and they pretty much, you know, confer with his review that, you know, he's in, he's out. and then that's it pretty much. I put on my review, as Dave said, was it worth going back at all if you can't change anything? And one of the things I left out in the review is the way it opens up, very much opens up like Around the World in 80 Days, where Phineas Fogg goes to like the Explorers Club or whatever, and they make the wager about him not being able to go around the world in 80 days in that movie. Of course, David Niven is delightful in that one, but we kind of get this at the club that he's at where they're discussing time travel. And it's nice that they bring up fixed point in time right at the very beginning of the conversation, because, you know, that's the one thing that the Doctor in Doctor Who always talks about is a fixed point in time situation. So here again, like I said, other series takes things from the Twilight Zone. But, you know, it was a bad joke by God or the powers to be. Maybe during that time he decided, well, let's put Peter to the test and see if he can do anything about it. And then, you know, one instance he's here, one instance he's back, and then he's looked on like a loony or a maniac because nobody believes him except for that policeman who
Robert,
was able to change the time.
Can I just interrupt, because it suddenly occurred to me that it would have perhaps worked well that when he came back to the club, the chap that met him at the door would say, you know, you're late for your shift, and give him his porter's coat, and he turns out to have now been demoted to be the porter.
Yeah.
That's cool. Dave always has these awesome endings.
I just didn't like the way he transported, you know, because that's the thing. You know, I like the beginning of the story. I think it's great. The ending with a twist is fine, but the middle seems to drag in this story for me. And
how long did you take crawling across the floor?
Well, how many times did you run around for about, you know, 15 minutes saying, you know, Chicken Little, the sky is falling situation,
exactly,
where people have to believe, yeah.
Right, and then when he woke up, we had to watch about 4 minutes of him crawling across the floor, knocking over the chair. I mean, my God, it's like, so will you get up off the damn floor already?
That's a chapter moment. I must get myself.
Yeah.
Up.
Well, Lynn, just to add in there, when I first rewatched this today earlier for the show, I watched it on YouTube, where it was one of these sites where, you know what they do with the Twilight Zone, they take out the middle section, so you can watch the first 10 minutes and you can watch the final 6 minutes, and YouTube has removed the middle heart, the middle section. Well, the first place, I forgot about the other place that we can go to and watch them. So I went there and I watched the beginning and I watched the end, and I suddenly thought, I don't actually really need to see the middle.
Because the middle's all him crawling across the floor.
I know, trying to get people to convince.
Oh my God, I'm getting up off this floor. Help me, please. Like,
I'm not telling you my name is John Wilkes Booth, but here, have a drink. Now, why would I be suspicious of that drink?
Why is this man taking me back to his hotel, exactly?
It took him 5 minutes to realize he was drugged. I never felt like this before. You drugged? And he's out, yeah. It's like, okay. Now I must go and do my deed and go kill the president. Probably saying to himself, he's walking out the door. But that's the thing. It's just, there's no object used in this. It's just like, you know, a flashback thing from Wayne's World or something like that, just like that type thing. I mean, you know, there's no coin. It would have been more believable if he had a coin or a watch that was owned by Lincoln's relative back in the 1800s, or just something to, here again, is this a parallel timeline, or is it, of course, we find this out later on in other series of movies, a genetic line jump? Is that really, did he really jump or go back in time, or did he go back in time into his predecessor, someone that was related to him in his bloodline?
Well,
that's,
I know, it's
a good idea on that.
I would have rather seen John Wilkes Booth knock him over the head with something, and then maybe he would have got off the floor a little bit sooner.
Trip off the steps, why don't you?
Yeah, you
go. could have been more convincing. Oh my goodness. But my question, and I'll bring this up after we get done with the reviews here about Rod Serling, I'll bring it up at the end, but shows that came to mind with me, and of course Dave went with the 10th Doctor. I'm going with the first Doctor with this one, Dave. All the way back to, I think, the sixth story of the William Parnell series, and that is the Aztecs.
It's no good, Doctor. My mind's made up. This is the beginning of the end.
We will honor you with blood.
The Aztec commander who killed the chosen servant of Yataxa.
That was the tragedy of the Aztecs. The whole civilization was completely destroyed.
The Aztecs, they knew how to build.
We shall deliver the human sacrifice to Tlatoxal.
Hold him down.
Human sacrifice is essential.
I could start the destruction.
You can't rewrite history. Not one lie.
No!
I shall destroy her.
Now, they go back in time. They, land in the era of the Aztecs. I think it was 1400s or something like that. Not for sure about the time. Where Barbara becomes queen of the Aztecs. And with that one, you face the dilemma because she knows the history of the Aztecs and she wants to try to stop the sacrifices. And the Doctor, on one of the rare times, because we know how the Doctor kind of interferes and stuff, but in this point, he brings up the fact that it's a fixed point, that you can't change this timeline, not, you know, one line of it. And then we see in the story that, you know, the people are what they are, and they still sacrifice people even when the Doctor then leaves. So there really wasn't any difference in time that Barbara or the Doctor or any of them could do in that one. So that was a good one to bring up. And even Quantum Leap, the episode Lee Harvey Oswald.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Channel's Quantum Leap Marathon. I'm your host, Scott Bakula. I play Dr. Sam Beckett, who took a quantum leap through time. Every leap was an amazing adventure, and this episode marks the first time Sam leaps into an historical figure. And what a figure. Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President Kennedy. Oh boy. This was a controversial two-part episode and a fascinating one. It includes a scene where Oswald meets a fellow Marine named Don Belisario, who later became the creator of Quantum Leap. That meeting actually happened. You'll see that scene and much more as you watch Lee Harvey Oswald. Some Quantum Leap background. I play time leaper Dr. Sam Beckett. I'm assisted by my friend Al, and we're both helped by Ziggy, a parallel hybrid computer which Sam built in the future at Project Quantum Leap. Al's colorful and noisy handling lets him use Ziggy to figure out our mission and calculate the odds as to whether we can change history. When Sam leaps through time and becomes another person, he's understandably a little confused and disoriented. But he's still himself and in control of his actions. Well, this time it's different. Sam's memories and personality have blended with those of Lee Harvey Oswald.
What if I assassinate the president?
You're not going to assassinate the president?
Sam has good reason to be worried. If he doesn't gain the upper hand, it will be Sam and not Oswald who's responsible for one of the greatest crimes of the century. When Sam leaps into the past, the person he replaces ends up in the future, in the waiting room at Project Quantum Leap. That's a place we rarely see. But this time, Sam has replaced Lee Harvey Oswald, and the waiting room scenes are important to the story.
I want a lawyer. There's no lawyer here. There's just me and you and the truth.
Naturally, Sam and Al are desperate to prevent one of the great tragedies of the 20th century in this very special episode of Quantum Leap.
Lee Harvey Oswald is a good one where Sam leaps into Lee Harvey Oswald. Here again, he feels this is a chance for him to stop the assassination of President Kennedy. But then his mind and Lee Harvey Oswald's mind start to blend together to where it comes to the very end, spoiler for people, that he wasn't sent to save the president, but he was sent to save his wife from being killed. Because if you remember that episode, he leaps from Lee Harvey Oswald into the Secret Service man, and he protects Jacqueline Kennedy. Kind of a parallel time situation with that episode, too. And also, they do it again later on in the fifth season with The Leap Between the States. Now, this is the one where I kind of tie this in with this episode, where Sam leaps into his great-great-grandfather down the genetic line. Tries to get his great-great-grandfather together and the grandmother, future grandmother together, because if you don't, then we get the Back to the Future situation again, where if his grandfather and grandmother don't meet, then his timeline isn't established in that one. And another one, too, is the movie Trancers.
I'm Jack Death. I'm a trooper in the 23rd century.
Jack Death, Angel City PD. May I see your stats?
What did I do?
Under Section 7 of the Penal Code, the council authorized me to administer you a transfer suspect examination.
You can't give me a TSE without a warrant.
I got your warrant right here, pal.
Okay. I don't want any trouble.
Hold out your...
My job is hunting transfers.
I got nothing to hide.
Finding them.
Negative.
And singeing them.
Look out!
Of course, sometimes they find me first. Then it's a little more complicated.
How do you know Whistler's location?
We monitored a line disruption in Los Angeles, December 1985. Van Zandt, Ash, and I all had ancestors in the city then.
If you think I'm bringing that scum up the line, you got the wrong trooper.
Unless you stop Whistler, everything the council has accomplished for the last 40 years will count for nothing.
Okay, let's say I believe this. You're a cop from the future and you're chasing this guy Piper.
Whistler.
Why doesn't he just turn you into one of these zombies? Or me?
Trancing only works on squids, people with weak minds, easily controlled. Lena, I'm from another time, another world. I don't even know what you people eat for lunch.
Okay, I got fried rice, egg rolls, and beef chow mein.
Beef? You like from a cow?
I thought it was rough in the 23rd century. I didn't know how hot it could get.
Jack?
How's my tan? It was getting hotter all the time.
Jack?
I guess I just attract a certain element no matter what century I'm in. Anyway, I gotta run now.
I wanna ride with the lady.
Over here, Ashbeat!
Jack Death is back. And he's never even been here before. Trancers.
One of my guilty pleasures, the first Trancer, Tim Thomason plays Jack Death, where he goes back in time to get the criminal called Whistler. And with that one, they time travel through genetics as well. But they have to have the kick with the drug in order to have him go back in time into someone that is related to him down their bloodline. So I would rather believe something like that instead of just a fainting spell that Peter has and then next time he wakes up and then how does he come back? It's nothing, you know, it's like all of a sudden he's waking up and he's back to original time again. So yeah. Like I said, there's some faults with this. And also music wise, very interesting that this is music was done by Jerry Goldsmith. Now, Jerry Goldsmith, you know, did music for the Sand Pebbles, the five Star Trek movies, Rio Lobo.
Right.
The Time Zone, the movie one he did for that as well, Aliens and Legend. But during that time, he was hired by CBS.
I actually thought this wasn't a bad musical score. Did you not like it?
It was okay.
Yeah, I
but
didn't think it was too bad.
He does much
better
down the
great.
Line.
It wasn't as good as 100 Yards Over the Rim, but it was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, down the road, he gets better. I mean, he's no, you know, John Williams, but, you know, he
yeah,
still
exactly.
does pretty good. Well, what my rating is a 3 out of 5 as well. I believe this was good as well. So I'll pass this over to Bobby. What do you think, Bobby?
Okay. Thank you, Robert. It took so long to get to me today. On the show, I decided to go forward into the future, so I already know what everybody said, including myself, but I'll repeat it anyway. Rather than get into the mechanics of this episode, since everybody else has already done that, I'd rather go down a different road, and that is the fact that although I'm a sucker for time travel stories like everybody else is, especially because when I was in school, history was my favorite subject and the only one I was any good at. And I'd rather go down a different road in first of all, noting that in every time travel story, somebody always either goes back, if they go back to the past, they always go back to a specific incident for a dramatic effect, such as the assassination of a president or whatever. And then it's an exercise in futility. It's always an exercise in futility. And if you've seen enough time travel stories in your life, you know that it isn't going to work no matter what they do. They're not going to be able to change history no matter what. But they try anyway. And but I get a little frustrated, even though I enjoy all the time travel stories, I get a little frustrated because I would like to see a writer write a time travel story in which the main character actually is able to change history. Because there's always this assumption that if you could go back and change history, it would be for the better. But I disagree with that. There's no guarantee it will be for the better at all. You could really screw up history totally. You could change the world in a different way, and we might be in a much different place today, even worse than where we are. So that I find that more intriguing than just always watching some character go back and try to stop an assassination or some terrible world event, and only to fail at the very end anyway. It's just, it gets a little tedious after a while. I like this episode, but, you know, after a while, you it's so obvious where it's going, there's not a whole lot of interest in it. So I would really like to see somebody write a story like that. You can name all kinds of historical events just in the past century, and some of them have already been named here, such as, let's just presuppose that somebody would be able, that you were back in 1963, and somebody showed up to tell you that Kennedy was going to be assassinated, and there is a way to stop it if you know in time. All right, that's fine. And so he doesn't get assassinated. How does that change world history if he doesn't? For instance, he got assassinated, and Lyndon Johnson became president right away. And eventually, Lyndon Johnson ratcheted up the Vietnam War. And historians, everything I've ever read, most people say Kennedy had always said that he did not intend to broaden the war. Of course, that might have changed, and that might never have happened. If he had lived and it hadn't happened, how many lives would have been saved? Would many people be alive today who now aren't because of the Vietnam War? What would have changed in that respect? Johnson, if Kennedy had run two terms, Johnson would have become president probably in 68 anyway, and the same thing might have happened, but we don't know. The same thing, Lennon already mentioned the movie The Final Countdown, the same thing is true of Pearl Harbor. If you go back to Pearl Harbor and you warn that it's coming and you can be ready for it, is that really such a good idea? Sure, you'll save all of those sailors' lives, many innocent lives, but Pearl Harbor ended up being a rallying cry for getting into World War II against Japan. Would this country have gotten in so readily? I mean, would we really have been willing to get into a war with Japan and Germany at the same time? And what would have happened if we had not? I've seen the stories and documentaries that suggest that Japan made a terrible mistake by attacking Pearl Harbor because all that did was piss us off and get us to come back at them. So if you were able to go back and change that, is it a good idea, or should things just stay the way they are? That's the only thing that's missing in time travel stories for me. I think it would have made it make them much more interesting. Somebody needs to write a story like that. It would have to be a much longer than half an hour, obviously. But I think you could go back. You could change your own life. Maybe if you change history, you simply disappear. You don't show up at all in the future. So there are a lot of dangers there. Every story I ever see says, oh, you go back and you can change it. You can stop the assassination. You can stop this. You can stop that. I don't know. I don't know that it's worth the risk.
Sure. But the thing is, to be able to go back once you see the repercussions and try to go back to the point where you change it to get the timeline fixed, which is kind of what Back to the Future is like.
Yeah, but if you do that, but then when you go back to your present time that you're in, everything will be changed. I mean, Rod Serling says at the end of the episode, you can't change world history, but there are parts of the fabric that can change just a little bit, such as the guy who ended up having all that money. Right. But I think it's just too risky to be doing a thing like that. And the other thing I wanted to say is it would never be successful in a million years for anybody to go back in time and warn anybody. It is, like I said, the exercise of futility. Why? Because human beings are natural born skeptics. If somebody had come along on September the 10th and said, I'm from the future, I know that the World Trade Center is going to be attacked, you've got to get everybody out of there. Okay, that's fine. But would anybody have believed it? No, of course not.
I'd lock you up in a heartbeat. I'd lock you up in a heartbeat.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And also, if you do that, then that puts you under suspicion. We would normally say, how do you know? Are you in on it? Did you get cold feet at the last minute? What's going on? What's your part in this? Even if you could convince us to even listen. But I think that nobody listens because there's no point of reference. It hasn't happened yet. You have to have it happen first. Now, where we are right now today, in 2011, most of us were alive during the assassination of Kennedy, and we saw the World Trade Center and the other horrible things that have happened. So we realize what the consequences are. But if somebody just shows up all of a sudden and says, somebody's going to attack buildings when it has never happened before, we would just say, that's an interesting fictional story. You ought to write a book about it. But it's almost laughable. That's why it doesn't work. You have to see it first. Now, today, if somebody came along and said, I know that somebody's going to attack the Sears Tower in Chicago, we would listen to that. You bet we would listen to that because we've already seen what the consequences are of not paying attention. So we know that better. And the same thing with airlines and the increased security at airports all came about because these horrible things happened. Like anybody, I wish none of them had. I wish Kennedy had never been assassinated, nobody died in the World Trade Center. But, you know, we are where we are because of the things that happened. And I personally think it's dangerous to kind of tweak history, even if you can. It's just too risky to do that. All these time travel stories, I'll watch them endlessly. I'm a sucker for every one of them. Whenever anyone's on, I'll watch it because it's always interesting. But you sit there and you just know, sure, go ahead, spend all your time trying to solve the assassination. You're just wasting your time. It's simply not going to work. The episode itself is decent. How much can you do in, 23 minutes after commercials? You can't really do a whole lot. So I'm not bothered, by the way, by the fact that we don't know how he stepped into a different dimension, that he just walked through a door and he was there. I don't have to really know that. One of my favorite movies when I was 13 years old in 1960 is The Time Machine with Rod Taylor, who plays H.G. Wells in the movie. It's really an excellent movie, and it's much more fully realized than this short story is because he goes backwards and forwards in time. He does it because he wants to see – well, he goes forward because he wants to see what wonderful things humans have turned into, only to find that we destroyed the planet and there's a whole new civilization living underground. He goes backwards in time, and he actually gets caught in nuclear war, and he just gets out of there in time. It's a fascinating story. I think it's very well done. It's always my favorite. It hasn't been on TV in years. I don't have the DVD of it. But anybody who hasn't seen it should watch it because of all the time travel stories, that one is really more fully realized and is more interesting. And again, but it's the same story there. He actually, in that movie, there isn't really an effort to really change anything until the end. It's at the end of the movie that he changes history. But the whole first part of the movie, he's just experiencing it. He just goes along from year to year to year and sees all these things happening. Fashion is changing, the world changing, and he's kind of fascinated by it. It's not until later in the movie that he tries to change his own life at the very end. But I would say if you want to watch a time travel story, that's the one to watch. But I also gave this episode a 3. I think it's pretty good. Recently on the board when we were reviewing something, I said that the Twilight Zone depends too much on time travel stories. It's just too easy. I sometimes think that Sterling's taking the easy way out. He's simply, you can always do a time travel story. The one we're reviewing on the board right now, 100 Yards Over the Rim, is another time travel story in which a man crosses a time barrier.
Crosses over and has no explanation for why he went back in time.
Right. So, tell me about it. And so, we're going to see more in the future. We're only a third of the way through the series. There are going to be more time travel stories.
Yeah.
But I like them. I don't really criticize it, but I think maybe we're just depending on them just a little too much. You just tweak it a little bit and change it, but it's always the same result. It's just pure futility. Personally, if I could go back in time and I knew something was going to happen, I probably would try to tell somebody because you have a chance to save lives. If you can save Lincoln's life, if you can save thousands of people's lives in the World Trade Center, you're obligated to try and do that. But I think it's risky.
Basically futile. It's futile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, where we are right now in history, though, it's not a great place to be. You know, I mean, I'm not sure. It's rolling the dice. You really don't know the assumption there will be a better world is not necessarily true. It might just be an even worse world. I'm not sure I want to take that particular risk.
But
so
I assume that the thing in the time in the Time Machine movie, the character had the foresight to build a model to show it.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
A lot of times nobody has the proof or to show that it's possible to do it. He takes a cigar, makes it like a little man, sticks it into the small version of the thing, and it disappears.
Yeah,
but
and
Robert,
he has three
Robert,
friends there to witness it. So,
but Robert, remember, you've got to know about this movie, the one Time After Time with Malcolm McDowell.
Right, to bring it back.
Well, oh, yeah. Absolutely. I love that movie. That is a fabulous movie. And he has the time machine. He built it. It's down there in his basement. And freaking Jack the Ripper got in it, you know. And then he has to go chase after that. It's a great movie. Malcolm McDowell, Mary Steenburgen, fabulous movie.
Evan Warner
and
as
Robert
Jack the Ripper.
Well, one way they do get around this problem with some science fiction films is that they have a situation where, in actual fact, at the beginning of the story, world history is not our world history. So, in actual fact, the storyline is, like you say, Bobby, you mess with it at your peril. But basically what they do with those stories, they play a switch in as much as the history of the people within the story is different than the events of the story actually make the history to our history as it is now. So, in other words, they go back to somewhere where something that we believe did happen hadn't happened, and through their interference, it does happen. And one slight instance of that is the Star Trek episode City on the Edge of Forever with the Joan Collins in it, I think. And basically that, Kirk, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler at this age, Kirk has to let this woman die because the fact that she'd been saved had altered history and the natural events had not followed through. So he has to actually stand by not doing anything to make, history come to pass.
Well, with that one, you got the object, the guardian, where he goes through and able to get there.
Yeah.
All righty, Lynn, that's it for me.
Okay, and Kelly, you have anything to add to this?
Yeah.
After everybody gets done, I know.
Actually, I was going to mention, because Dave just mentioned that episode of Star Trek, because I started to think about that episode when Bob had mentioned, you know, what are the ramifications if you go back in time, and, you know, he was wondering about, you know, doing anything. And that episode was, I thought, a really good example of that, because they went back in time because Dr. McCoy had inadvertently prevented this seemingly innocent woman who, you know, really didn't appear when you first see her to be of anybody of importance. He saves her. They find out that he saves her from getting hit by a car. And then they find out. Right. And because he saved her from getting hit by a car, she ends up becoming a very important figure eventually and leads a peace movement in the United States, which delayed the United States' entry into the Second World War. And Spock found out that Germany had created the A-bomb before the United States did. And that's why Germany won the war.
I thought you were going to say it was Eleanor Roosevelt.
No.
Yeah, because somebody told a story about that once before. I thought it was Eleanor Roosevelt.
No. Joan Collins was just playing a woman who worked in a homeless shelter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was just, you know, and she was just, you know, she was just somebody who did a lot of things for the poor, and she became like a community activist. You know, and supposedly after he saved her from getting hit by a car, she started to become more popular in the neighborhood, and she started to become a community activist, and her and she just got involved in a peace movement as Fox called it.
Yeah.
It was a big pacifist movement developed within the United States, and she was kind of one of the big leaders of it. And he concluded that, and that was why it delayed the United States entry into the Second World War, enabling Germany to hence develop the A bomb before we did, and Germany won the war. And so, as you see, a very dramatic moment in that episode where Spock says to Kirk, in order for history to resume its natural order, Edith Keeler must die, as she was supposed to, in a car accident. And at the end, when McCoy comes out, he's going to save her. Kirk literally has to grab McCoy and prevent her and prevent him from saving her. And she ends up getting hit by the car and she dies.
Line at the end. It says, "Jim, do you know what you've done?"
Yes.
And Spock goes, "He does. He does." So.
Yeah, and it's a very sad episode, but it's also, I think, one of the very best episodes that they ever did. You know, that you have to realize you got to sacrifice one person to save a billion. So I thought that's an interesting paradox there. You know, doing something so seemingly so innocent. I mean, and the same thing happens in the movie Back to the Future, where Marty McFly goes back in time and he inadvertently prevents the first meeting of his parents and realizes that things are starting to change and he's got to force his parents to meet. But of course, because he changed the circumstances under which his parents meet, he ends up inadvertently changing the future. Granted, it changed the future for the better, but you still don't know what other ripples there were as a result of that.
Remember the note? Remember the note, though? He gave the note to to Christopher Lord.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
if he had not given the note, telling him he was going to be shot,
exactly,
he would not have worn that bulletproof vest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, you know, you got all these nice little interesting paradoxes. But I was going to talk about, too, you know, you were taking issue with how Peter got to the past in this episode. And that never really bothered me because if anybody here, I'm sure there's people here who saw the movie Peggy Sue Got Married. That's pretty much how Peggy Sue went to the past. The movie starts out, she's at her 25-year class reunion for high school, and she ends up passing out, and when she wakes up, she's back in her senior year of high school, and it turns out she had passed out while giving blood at a school blood drive. And so hence you see her interacting with people in the year 1960, and she has all the knowledge from 25 years earlier. Although she ends up, on the one hand, she does change a few things, but she doesn't really change anything dramatically because at the end, she still ends up with her high school sweetheart, who she married, who she initially was going to say she was never going to marry him. But then she ends up doing that because she also realizes that without him, she wouldn't have her kids. So the whole idea of Peter, you know, feeling faint as he walks out, that didn't really bother me. I do think that the change in clothes was a little strange. You would have thought that he would have been wearing his regular clothes when that happened to him. But, you know, what the heck? It's the Twilight Zone. Why not? That's what makes the Twilight Zone such a cool show, is that basically anything's possible. The other thing that I liked about this was that it was obvious that he was, you know, going into it. As soon as you realize it's the night of the Lincoln assassination, it's a foregone conclusion that he's not going to be able to change that. And as far as recognizing John Wilkes Booth, I have to admit, I think I might have been, at the very least, been suspicious of this guy. I mean, because everybody knows, I mean, if you've never seen a photograph of him too many times, I think most people know that John Wilkes Booth was a guy with dark hair and had a mustache and was a very handsome man. So you would think that that might set off a few alarm bells. And as for Booth going into the police station and saying that he's a doctor, I thought that he handed somebody like a business card to show who he was.
Yeah, he handed a business card.
Yeah, and but I mean,
still,
and I'm kind of inclined
to turn somebody over to somebody just so they hand a business card.
I don't know. I mean, this is the year 1865. I mean, remember last time we were talking about an episode where they were talking, you know, where it was a public hanging, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of due process of law back then. I mean, lynching mobs could go out and hang people. So I'm inclined to think that maybe in 1865 it might have been a little more lax in a police station.
That's pretty lax, I'll tell you.
Somebody
goes in there and says, "Hey, you just brought a prostitute in there. I'd like to take her home with me."
But remember, too, this is also the days before people had picture ID. So,
right. Just a stranger. I mean, come on.
But still, I mean, he's nicely dressed. He's speaking very eloquently, and he's got business cards. And Peter Corrigan seemed perfectly happy to walk out the door with him. You know, I would think that if Peter Corrigan had said, "Wait a minute, I don't want to go with this guy, man. No way. You know, just keep me locked up." I mean, but he didn't give any indication that he was in distress over walking out the door with this guy.
He wanted to get out of there. He wanted to go. He was in jail.
That's true.
I am not buying that somebody should just walk in and say, "I would like to take that prisoner home with me." I'm not.
Well, you can be anybody you want to in that era because, like Kelly says, you don't have no picture ID. Flyers were around even back in the early 1700s. Business cards, I could imagine, you know, "Hey, my name is such and such. Can you print me this business card?" Well, the printer there, as long as you have the money, he's going to print up whoever it is. I want to be Johnny Walker, I'll print up Johnny Walker.
Does that mean you still turn over anybody to anybody?
But keep in mind that Peter Corrigan didn't really appear to be that much of a threat to society. I mean, he wasn't arrested because he was threatening anybody with a gun or a knife or anything. He was just kind of saying, from their viewpoint, he was just kind of saying some crazy things.
Actually arrested as such, was he? They just said let him sleep off in the cells.
I'm inclined to think that they probably weren't that concerned, and that's why I guess Lynn, you and I will have to just agree that we disagree on that point. Okay. I'm inclined to think, you know, if I was in 1865 and John Wilkes Booth had approached me, I think I probably would kind of recognize him because I've seen a lot of photographs of him over the years, and I've also seen, you know, I've seen documentaries about the Lincoln assassination, so I've actually seen a very famous photograph of the man many times. One of the things that I really did like about this was just the fact that, you know, while we didn't see him change the Lincoln assassination, we got to see how a small change occurred. Because one of the things that the history books will definitely tell you is what happened to this country when Lincoln got assassinated. But some of the things that you don't hear about are the little things, like what happened to the people who were at the theater that night. I mean, you know, because of John Wilkes Booth and his actions, he inadvertently destroyed some lives of innocent people who were there who had nothing to do with the assassination. For example, all of the actors who were on that stage that night in the play Our American Cousin, any of them who wanted to work in the theater again had to change their names. Because nobody would hire them because they did not want any kind of association with the Lincoln assassination. Those people had to literally change their names. The play, Our American Cousin, that was written in 1858 by an English playwright, it was a play that was very, very popular in England, and it had just started being performed in the United States. Nobody would touch that play for decades on the stage. So that playwright lost royalties because his play did not get performed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the owner of Ford's Theater, John Ford, the government literally seized his theater from him. And they paid him $100,000, which was a lot of money in 1865. But that man lost his theater because of John Wilkes Booth. And that play... that that theater for years was used as offices and as a warehouse, and it was not opened up again where plays were performed until 1968, because people did not want, you know, a place where an assassination had been done to be. They did not feel like it should be a place where happy things happened, and so that's why I like this episode, because it's the little things that you don't hear about, and Peter Corrigan, who thought he was going to try to make some this great change, he ended up making this really small change. And what would be interesting, unfortunately, because we only had a 23-minute show, but you know, he somehow inadvertently changed the future of this one man, you know, because his ancestor actually listened to him and took him seriously and started telling everybody that Lincoln was going to be assassinated. It makes you wonder if there was kind of a ripple effect. I mean, did something, you know, what, because of this one guy getting, he became chief of police.
I think he became mayor.
Yeah. But what happened to the guys who originally had those jobs before this guy's great-grandfather had those jobs? What became of them and their subsequent descendants? You know, did Peter Corrigan, while he ended up helping Williams' family, did he ultimately end up screwing somebody else's family over in the process? So Those are just my thoughts on that. I liked it. This is one of my favorite episodes of season two. I enjoy it every time I watch it. I gave it a 3 for good, simply because I just kind of thought that it never once crossed his mind that it might have been Booth who got him out of there, because he wanted to take control of the situation. I thought he was a little too naive to go off with this Wellington guy.
Oh, I still think that, you know, going back 100 years in time, even if you see photographs, I don't think sometimes if you were to go back 100 years and somebody actually comes up to you face to face, I don't think you would automatically recognize them. I mean, I know we're going to disagree on this, but I just don't think you would, because dark-haired man, dark mustache, good-looking, what, he's the only one? I can't believe that I would automatically recognize him.
Well, you know, the thing is, time travel can also be linked to premonitions as well, and a good movie with that is The Zed Zone, written by Stephen King.
Oh, yeah,
King,
yeah. Yeah, I've seen that. That's good.
The character who gets into an accident, and he's able to see into the future, and he sees the future president of that movie causing nuclear war. So now he has to go through and prevent that,
mm-hmm.
which is a good movie.
Yeah.
But my question I was going to bring up at the end here was, how much, and with everybody here, I imagine everybody has knowledge and background of Rod Serling, how much did he really know about this type of stuff, because he wrote this story? Did he know about parallel worlds and all these other things?
I always just thought he just wrote this stuff because he had a really good imagination.
Hmm.
Well, actually, his wife was asked that in an interview, how much he knew about this kind of stuff. And she said basically he didn't know a whole lot about it, but he kind of winged it. He winged it because he would read things about it, but he just took it one step at a time with his stories. You know, he wasn't an expert on it or anything, but according to Carol Serling, it was something that he was very interested in and something he wanted to play around with in his stories, but he was no expert. Of course not.
Yeah, well, I think he simply read The Time Machine by H.G. Wells and decided to turn it into 25 episodes of his TV.
There you go.
I have, if we're coming to the end here, I have one more thing to read here. Lynn and I were at Craigslist on the internet earlier today.
Oh, Craigslist,
In the best of Craigslist section, and we found a rather ironic post by somebody, and I'll simply read it. It's not very long, exactly as it is. The subject matter simply says time travel. It's dated September 24th, 2010, and it says this: I have a functioning time machine. I know it sounds unbelievable, but I assure you it works, that I need a second person to operate with me. I'm looking for someone who is adventurous and reliable, preferably a male or a female that can do heavy lifting. I am leaving on September 30th, 2010, in the morning, and plan to return October 2nd, 2010. I am going to June 1983 to handle some business. If you are serious about time travel and are reliable, then please contact me. You do not have to pay anything, but you would have to provide someone to watch my cat for the time we are gone. The only qualifications needed are that you are reliable and that the circumference of your head is no more than 64 centimeters. We will be leaving from Bozeman, Montana. Let me know if you want to go with me. There is no follow-up, so we never know what happened.
Oh, my goodness.
It just kills me because the guy is asking the person he wants to come with him to provide someone to watch their cat. Okay, suppose somebody from New York City replies, yeah, I'd like to come with you. Now, how is that person supposed to provide somebody to watch his cat in Montana? Cut me a break. This guy was totally... Yeah, okay, I'm from New York, but I'll find someone in Montana to watch your cat.
Well, actually, my first thought was I'd be scared to respond to that simply because you kind of wonder, is this some kind of crazy psycho person? I mean, you keep hearing stories about psychos that are killing, that, you know, that you find people that they wanted to buy something on Craigslist, and then these people go there and they end up getting killed. You know, it makes you wonder about this person.
I would have liked to, because my head's small. I have a small head. I could have done a 64 circumference. I want to go back. We need to go back to 1983. I got some business I can take care of there, too. Yeah.
Be like Doc Brown. I got a time machine. I have to go and travel back to the past.
The man has a functioning time machine, Robert. We could have all gone back with him.
I want to point out one other thing, too, before we go, and that is we talk a lot about going back to the past, but it can also be very dangerous to go to the future. Just ask the lead character, Charlton Heston's character in Planet of the Apes, how dangerous that can be, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's
good. He looks so good with his shirt off, though. Didn't he look so good with his shirt off?
Charlton Heston looks good in just about anything.
Charlton Heston will look good in wrapped up in aluminum foil. That man was just, absolutely.
No, he didn't look that good in a rug.
He looked good in a rug.
On top of his head.
Aw, Dave. All right, so he takes that off. But other than that, he looks damn good, right? Well, I wouldn't ask you. You're a guy, Dave. I can't ask you. That's
Lynn, take it from me. I agree with you. Charlton Heston always looked good. I mean, he's one of those guys that just aged real gracefully. I mean, he looked good even in did you ever see the last movie that he made an appearance in?
I've seen every movie that man has ever made.
The movie that True Lies movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember him in that?
Yeah,
he had one scene in that, and he was like, in his 70s at that point, and he still looked just as good as ever, I thought.
And then seeing him in Ben-Hur when he was rowing that boat with no shirt on, and he was all sweaty. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, this is me. Oh, anyway. Okay, well, before I get too sweaty here.
Better get a fan on you, Lynn.
All right. Bobby, I'm still here, honey. I love you, darling.
Thank you.
Live on for Wiener from the Time Machine.
Right.
Oh, yeah, there you are. All right, well, what are we doing? 2 weeks from now.
The whole truth. It's going to be Haney Day. Mr. Douglas, I have a deal for you.
Yes, April 23rd. Jack Carson in The Whole Truth. A really episode.
Stellar episode.
Yes, and it is videotaped. It is a videotaped one, so it's not one of our favorites. But we will be doing that in 2 weeks. So I hope to see everyone here 2 weeks from now to just talk about this wonderfully videotaped episode. Okay, so folks, I will see you in 2 weeks. Okay, and have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.